Well, this weekend has certainly been a series of treats, and this afternoon we get to have the cherry on top of the sundae with Avery Springer and Jim Lowe, who teach at John Burroughs School. I have friends in Germany who are classicists, you know, and the job market there is as bad as it is here for classicists. And one of the things that they say when you ask how thus and such a person is, naja, vielleicht muss er in die Schule gehen. Perhaps he's going to have to go off to a grade school. And it's regarded as a shameful thing for the Germans with a PhD and a Habilitationsschrift to go teach in the high schools. I don't think it's very much the same thing at all here in the United States of America, and thank goodness. Both Avery Springer and Jim Lowe have PhDs from the University of Madison, University of Wisconsin at Madison. Jim wrote on St. Augustine, and Avery wrote on Prudentius, who is a Christian poet of the 5th century. They run a remarkable Latin and Greek program at John Burroughs School, which is just outside of St. Louis, or is it in Greater St. Louis, really? And they have a lot of wisdom to share with us who are trying to get the classical tradition revived in our own schools. And so I ask you to welcome with me Jim Lowe and Avery Springer.
Well, thank you. Now, is this working? You can hear me? Thank you very much. You've just heard a little bit about who we are from John. I'll tell you just a little bit more about the school we teach at. It's a private preparatory school, non-denominational, totally secular, so that colors some of what we will present to you today. Starts in 7th grade and goes through 12th grade, so though we aren't technically teaching 11-year-olds, I'm going to talk about them anyway, but we're a little interested to know who some of you are. Maybe I won't step away, but how many of you are actually teachers? And how many of you know any Latin at all? Oh, that's wonderful. That's brilliant. And how many of you might be like school administrators or on the board of trustees? Ah, bummer. Those are probably the people we really need to be talking to. Those are the people we have to convince of what we're saying today. But nevertheless, we do hope that this will give you some ideas about how you might begin a program of the sort that has been talked about much over the last day and a half.
What we're going to do is sort of split up, excuse me, in talking in these sections of this talk, and I am going to attempt to make the technology work. But if it doesn't, I'll start dancing, then you'll go away. And we're going to try to leave time at the end for questions, so that's our intention. So I think I'd like to ask you, if you have a question that comes up midway, try to hold it to the end, then we'll cover them then. So Avery's going to do the first bit.
Okay, so Latin instruction. Well, first of all, you talk about studying the classics, and you have to be really sure that the person you're talking to knows what you mean by that. I have often said to someone, oh yes, I study the classics, and they say, oh really? What instrument do you play? Or, oh yeah, I read Robert Louis Stevenson once. And so you need to make it very clear that what we are mostly talking about when we talk about studying the classics is, of course, the ancient Greek and Roman world and the Middle East as well. But particularly, traditionally, it has meant studying Latin and Greek. And you know, the problem with today's world, and maybe you all are in fact convinced that it's really important to study Latin and Greek, but you know, who's got the time? You talk about a curriculum. Ever since Sputnik, which some of you are probably younger enough you don't even remember, but it was like a terrible sea change from our perspective, where the United States suddenly felt it had fallen behind in the space race, therefore we had to stop studying these things which were extraneous, unnecessary, and just possibly elitist. For that, read Latin. Latin used to be almost universal in the high schools in this country. It used to be required of an entering student in many of the colleges, never mind someone headed into the seminary or a place like that. So it used to really, in fact, be a kind of empire. There's a wonderful history of Latin called Empire of the Sign. But that empire, like others, have fallen on hard times. The very first school founded in this country was called the Boston Latin School. And to this day, it is a flourishing school. At the time, five of the signers of the Declaration of Independence had gone to school there. So, unfortunately, Sputnik made us decide that really what was necessary was math and science. And Latin virtually disappeared from the high schools. Greek, we actually are blessed enough to be able to teach Greek where I teach now, but most high schools, there are very, very few of them that still teach Greek. So if we are convinced that it is, in fact, practical and necessary to teach Latin, Dorothy Sayers, whom we heard referenced in this morning's talk on rhetoric, sees grammar as the first element of the trivium. What are the other reasons? Let's say, why else might you want to study Latin? Not all eighth graders have necessarily decided already that they're interested in going on into the ministry, say, or even, heavens forbid, classics graduate school. So it does a number of things if you're talking about all students studying Latin. It opens the door for any further language study. Does wonderful things, we'll talk about this in just a minute, in other ways. But how can you fit it in? And our argument today is that the best time to fit it in is as early as you can possibly manage it. We heard the joke the other day about the monolingual American. In Norway, for example, they start second language instruction, which I believe is English, when the students are in second grade. We lived for a couple of years in Germany, and our son, who was a fourth grader, as he moved into fifth grade, went off to a klassisches Gymnasium, where all the fifth graders, all of them, were taking Latin. And it was a pretty amazing thing to see my son studying Latin in German. First of all, as a young, immersed person, he learned German in 4 months. I mean, he could speak it. He could almost write it. And then he was learning Latin. And whenever I had to help him, it was a triangle. I would have to go from German to English to Latin, or Latin to English to German. But he just went right straight across the bottom. So the young mind is a flexible mind. And as you're learning these things, if you learn a language at these early ages, you actually are building pathways for further language learning. And I have to say, I got very depressed after a while, watching my children being such brilliant linguists while I was still struggling along with Aja, dann, wie geht es Ihnen? So if we're interested in reviving the idea of classical language, the ideal time to start students studying a classical language is in middle school or junior high school. Though one could start with Greek, Latin has much to recommend it for all students. Has all these different, gives you such a great basis just to the entirety of the Western tradition as well as language. So, as well as other languages, including Greek eventually. So I think of Dr. Nordling's presentation this morning, and let's say that airplane pilot or the farmer, having decided at 35 or 40 that he wants to go into the ministry, what if he'd had 5 or 6 years of Latin in high school? Now, he hasn't been in a Latin class in years, but those fundamentals are going to be there. And his slide into Greek or Hebrew is going to be just that much easier if he started out with Latin. But then the question is, can you actually teach Latin to kids who are 11 or 12 years old? Isn't it kind of hard? Isn't it too dry for a spunky 11-year-old? Well, we hope that our presentation today might give you some ideas about how we have established a very fruitful program at John Burroughs School. We usually garner the kids coming in seventh grade have very few curricular choices, but one of them is which language do they study. An entering class is about 95 students. And the last 3 or 4 years, we've managed to attract about 20 to 25, so nearly 25%, of those students to take Latin. And many of them stay in our program for the entire 6 years. So we hope that you'll find some good ideas here for how you might develop a Latin program beginning in middle or junior high school. Now, one of the first steps that you want to make when you're starting a program is to decide what are your goals for Latin. Now, lots of people understand the sort of ancillary goals that Latin can help you read better. It can increase your vocabulary. It will help you if you want to take another modern language. So this would be Latin as an ancilla, a handmaiden to another program or an end. And there's lots of proof for this. If you look for just one place, everybody's very worried about SAT scores. So here's a chart of SAT scores in the reading and the mean scores over here to the side. This is for foreign and classical languages mixed together. It's always good to have done some language. But if you look at this red line here, the students who have taken Latin are significantly higher in their score than other languages. So this is a great thing to present to your board of directors or the administrative types. But we're here actually to argue that I guess I shouldn't say better, because this is a fine reason to study Latin. It also, the basis in grammar, it's wonderful for all sorts of parts of your next study, close reading, all these other things. But on the other hand, there is a whole lot more to studying Latin if you study it as an end in itself. So for example, this is a manuscript page showing the open lines of the Aeneid. When you study Latin, you almost inevitably study all of Roman culture. And usually the final effort that you will have in a senior level class is to read large portions of Virgil's Aeneid. But it isn't just the classical world that Latin opens up to you. It's the world of late antiquity and the early church. So here we have a manuscript of the Vulgate with the opening lines of John's Gospel in Latin. If you're good at reading that nice hand, then you can see what's going on there. The world of late antiquity, the Middle Ages, and of course, as we've heard over and over again today, the Reformation. And all of that is more deeply enriched and informed if you have a solid background in Latin and Roman culture. Now, one of the questions that you're going to always want to ask yourself is, who are we aiming this at? Are we aiming it at a general public, all of the kids? And actually, we think that that's a great idea. As John said today, he thinks he can teach Greek to anybody. We think you can teach Latin to anybody. On the other hand, if you may be working with a group of students that have certain learning differences, it's been an interesting thing, sort of totally counterintuitive, that students who struggle in certain areas with processing skills and things like that actually will feel very much at home in Latin over above a language like Spanish. Partly because we don't tend to say something in Spanish and expect them to come right back. If we ask them to translate Latin, it's something they're prepared to do. Littler kids, you're going to pace it different. Differently. Older kids, you can pace it more quickly. So you want to decide who you're teaching. And probably the biggest decision of all, and this is where I'm going to turn this over to my comrade here, Jim, because he and our other colleague were the ones who made this decision in our program, is which textbook, how are you going to frame your course in terms of a textbook? So Jim, over to you.
All right. Now, I was a little put off to see how many of you know Latin and are already teaching Latin, because I could make some enemies in a big hurry here, since Latin teachers tend to fall into fairly sensitive camps when it comes to what is the right textbook to use. And so even though I'm slightly off my own script, I thought about saying this and then wasn't going to, but I'll open with it again. And I'll tell you that my opinion is, yeah, I'm going to say it. There's no bad Latin text. There are bad teachers. There are no bad Latin texts. And the corollary is that anybody, I think, can make any text work. But we're going to show you what has worked for us And I'm going to try to tell you why I think it's a good choice for the level we're talking about, which is starting with 11 or, oh, you were so good. We have to have a shout out for our tech guys here. They are awesome. And otherwise, I would be dancing, and that's ugly. All right, so let's get on with this. Now, first thing you've got to realize, if you're thinking about course textbook adoption, and I'm leaving aside now external pressures like a board that's telling you to do one thing or another, but assuming you're on your own and you're making your choice, then you're gonna have to decide what you need. There's gonna be a fork in the road pretty soon, and here are the choices. On the one hand, you can go with what I call a traditional route, and I'll show you what that is, and I learned out of it. It works great. I'll bet a number of you did as well. But there's also another kind, which I call a reading-based. There are other names for it, but that's the one I'm gonna use. And the real issue then is, how do I choose? And you can be reduced to this Socratic level of perplexity here. What do I choose? So I'm gonna make some suggestions to you about the strengths, and I'm actually a firm believer now in this reading-based for my level, but I appreciate the strengths of the other, and has a lot to do with that question we had up earlier, which is, who is your audience anyway, and whom are you teaching? But we're right now assuming that we've got fairly younger kids whom we're teaching. In the background, some of you may want to come up afterwards and see this presentation on the smaller screen, because we have some very cool effects. And there's a background here, some nice Roman brickwork. So those of you out there who love Roman bricks, you know who you are. Come look at this afterward. I'm a brick myself. But anyway, some examples of what I'm now going to call old school. Those are sort of the traditional texts that you may have run into. That one I'm going to show you, I'll bet no one here has heard of, called Latin, A Course for Schools and Colleges. And I'll bet a number of you know of, learn from, or teach out of one called Wheelock's Latin, which is quite a hoary text. The reading-based ones, all three of these, as you can see, are in their origin from England or Scotland. The Ecce is a Scottish text, and the other two are English. And of course, as in everything else, Cambridge and Oxford have to fight as to who has the better one. We are in the Oxford camp ourselves, but they all work on more or less the same kinds of principles, which I will talk about. But in the criteria as I see it, and you could think of others, but the ones that come really to my mind are, of course, what age you're talking about. And at some point, you have to face the question of aptitude. And this comes in, sort of, there are two aspects of this to my mind. One is, I mean, are you dealing with pretty bright kids? And Avery and I are very privileged to be working with pretty bright kids. But the second aspect is, well, yes, maybe you have some bright kids, but maybe you have some less bright ones in the same classroom. And so that span of abilities is another thing to bear in mind as you're thinking about texts. My opinion is that the reading-based ones are better when you have a significant range of abilities in a classroom. But that's my opinion. Learning styles, Avery touched on that briefly. That's something to bear in mind. And then prior experience. Now, Avery and I teach at a school that takes kids from some independent elementary schools, and a number of those schools teach Latin. But it's sort of like learn to sing the body parts in Latin. And you know, that's highly amusing, but doesn't get them anywhere in actually learning Latin. So within the first 3 days, we're all on the same page. Yet, if they have had experience in other languages, they may have a leg up on certain others who haven't. All right, now, I'm gonna freely admit that I have this up here because largely I'm going to make fun of it. So if there are any relatives of Messrs. Anderson or Groen, I apologize in advance about this. This is the text used at Burroughs when I got there, and my other colleague, Philip, whom some of you know, well, as soon as we started using this, realized it had to go, and I'll try to show you why. But this is an example of what I would call a traditional, old-school approach. And it's hard to see it, but it's really sort of learn it or die, not necessarily in that order. And fortunately, I think this slide gives you some sense. And again, I know I'm being harsh, so pardon me, but this they're different, not necessarily bad, but look at this. In one chapter, you get the entire active indicative system of the third conjugation. That's efficient, but it can be kind of deadly at the same time for some kids. You got to teach this pretty cannily if you're not going to have an armed riot in your room. But it is efficient, it's all there. And actually, I will say this, and I do believe this very much, that for certain kids who have certain kinds of minds, this is a better way for them to take in the information. Because there are no bows in its future. What's that about? Well, you want to learn Latin right here? We got to start at the beginning if you want to know that. That's a great old riddle, though. More on that later. Lessons after the presentation. Now, check this out. When you teach a system like this, you get stuck when you're trying to give sentences for kids to practice. And you wouldn't believe this if I didn't have it up here, and you may not be able to read it, so I shall. Sentence one, I shall not eat dinner today because I have left my teeth in the city. That I did not Photoshop that sentence in there. Now, you know, that's a great sentence for practicing third conjugation future and third declension nouns, which has come up in the previous chapter. But you can forgive kids for looking and say, why would I study this language? And I'm racking my brain to think about pastoral applications of this as well. And I'll as I talk a little bit, you can look at the rest of the sentences because they are just as good as those. But that's, you're stuck with that pedagogically when you introduce syntax and grammar, first conjugation, second conjugation, third conjugation, and so forth. Now, Wheelock's Latin, I'll try to go through this relatively quickly. I've got a bunch of pages, so if it's a blur, I apologize, but I think even in the blur, you'll get the idea of what I'm talking about. This text has been around a long time. It's really introduced, I found out, when I read the preface, to enable all the GIs coming back to school after World War II to learn Latin with a kind of a newish text. And this was it's a very efficient text and still widely used. The thing I want to point out there is that this is a Joe Friday approach to Latin, all right? Just the facts. No frippery of any kind. There aren't even many photographs in this textbook. It's pretty much just get down to business, and it does do the job. Make no mistake about that. I don't know if I could do the research. My guess is this is still pretty widely used at later levels, like college. It's hard go for 11-year-olds. And I'm going to go through this quickly, and all I sort of want you to see is that in this one chapter, they go through all the cases. They have entire first declension, first the singular, and then the next page is the plural, agreement of adjectives, and a discussion of the syntax of the cases. This is, I think, the second or third chapter in the book, so you're out of the gate in a hurry. So if you want to have an approach like Professor Nordling's where we're going to do this fast, and if you can concentrate on it all by itself, this is a great approach for Latin. But in grade 7 in our school, these kids have a lot of other things to be thinking about beside Latin. And then you get what have been known forever as the sententia antiquae, which are actually bits of real Latin, but so ripped out of context, I always thought they made only marginal sense. And then just to show you, oh, there's some real Latin down there by Catullus, how exciting. I don't think so, because it's been so reconstituted, it doesn't look anything like Catullus anymore. So, sorry, but that's my own bias showing through. And then there's this last bit. Latina est gaudium et utilis. I don't know. Now, I just thought I'd put this in here for some of you who like this. I almost took a picture. I ran out of time. I went to Borders just to see what there was, and you'd be surprised at this shelf at Borders with things like The Dummy's Guide to Latin, Latin for Idiots. There's another one which was Latin and It Won't Be Scary or something like that. So the very titles on the shelves are disposing you to think this is a bad thing. So Oxford Latin course, that's pretty value neutral. Anyway, here's just an example of this, and this is hard to see. But in the eternal wisdom of this book, in the vocabulary they give you early on are words for tree, Caesar, meat, buttock, companion, leg, tooth, dictator, leader, thigh, and brother. Now, I almost put up a sentence using all those words in it, but good taste prevailed. But I'll allow you to make up your own sentence using those words. And then the grammar guru doesn't tell you actually anything about grammar, it's about etymology. And Avery said, well, but people mean everything by grammar. I said, well, I don't, so meh. Anyway, when they say Latin for idiots, well, more can we say? Now, I want to talk some about these reading-based. And again, I'm going to try to be relatively quick about this. And there are some issues I think it's good to know. And this is why we have found this other system useful. Grammar and syntax is introduced in organic sequence. And let me see if I can make sense of what I mean by this. Rather than introduce the declensions and the conjugations in numerical order, which gives you not much leeway for sentences for reasons that have just been made obvious, now what happens is that the grammar and syntax is introduced through the reading of exceedingly simple stories, and certainly nothing more than see, spot, run version of Latin. But because of that, the emphasis falls not on learning the first declension altogether, but rather in learning, say, the nominative and the accusative of three declensions in fairly short order so that you can have simple subject, verb, object sentences using almost any vocabulary you care to use. That makes a big difference. This kind of stuff, like the concept of a case, is introduced in a story of some kind, and the idea is that you kind of see it, as it were, in situ before you talk about it in a more formal way. There's an emphasis on reading right from the get-go. This is a huge one. I think there's one thing that's probably helped us in our program is that the teaching of the language is anchored, as it should be, of course, in a larger cultural milieu. So it's just, it arises out of something more than the language itself. And for those of you who can do it, I'm not one of them, it does give you an aspect to have an oral and aural aspect of the language. So here are some slides of pages from the Oxford Latin course, and I want to talk just briefly about them. Let me interrupt myself to say that if this goes by and you wish you'd seen it better and it went slower, I can probably reproduce this for anyone who wants and burn it on a disc and send it to you, and then you can use it as a caster for your drinks, which is probably what it's really good for. But anyway, so every chapter begins with some really stupid pictures and little captions which are meant to introduce the grammar. This one happens to be the distinction of singular and plural. And then there's a story, and it's a running story, and happens to be the biography of the man who becomes the poet, Horace. But then every chapter has got nice photographs, and every chapter has a section at the end that's about the culture in some way. This one happens to be the country town Venusia. Then in the back of the book, it's physically separated, there is what a lot of us would recognize as the more sort of traditional approach of drills, a formal explication of the grammatical principles, and so forth. But it's intentionally put at the back of the book because the authors want you to try to get the kids to infer this stuff from reading rather than whack them over the head with it and then read a sentence about teeth in the city. And so, just as an example here, I'll see if how well this turns out. What I want to do is, well, it turned completely black, but the Oxford Latin course in this chapter gives you the third person singular and plural for all four conjugations, whereas in the other approach you get all the tenses and all the persons and numbers at once. Now, what that means is the Oxford Latin course for a long time pretty much has to live in the third person, And as I tell my students, you have to live in the present this whole year because there are going to be no past tenses in the whole first volume. Again, some of you may think that's, I can't handle that. And that, if so, then stay away from this kind of a textbook. Here's another example, same thing, which is we have the nominative and accusative, and if I squint, I can see there are two declensions up there. Whereas, again, in the Wheelock, you get all the cases in one fell swoop. Now, the Wheelock's a lot more efficient. And one thing Avery reminded me of, and has said, is that we have the luxury of a lot of time. And that's one great thing about starting young is you don't have to go too fast. And if you don't have to go too fast, you can afford the time that this system needs, and it does need time. So be aware of that. There's some anecdote, I didn't have time to look it up, but something about Winston Churchill's brief Latin career ended when he thought that you'd actually say, oh, table, or something like that. Use of the vocative. But sure enough, here's a modern textbook which is encouraging to say, oh, large gates. Highly useful. Some day-to-day in the classroom things. I think this will come as a surprise to no one, but that's okay. And these day-to-day things that I'm suggesting work particularly with this reading-based approach. I think they're good for any kind of teaching, but they complement this textbook particularly well. Vary the activities, and what I say, I couldn't think of a better way of saying learning atmosphere, but all I mean by that is I've learned from bitter experience that if you expect 13 hormonally charged 12-year-olds to sit for 43 minutes straight learning one thing, you're in for a big surprise. And learning will end after about 10 minutes of one kind of lecture. So build in other things too. Less is sometimes more. If you use one of these reading-based approaches, there's a great temptation on your part, if you know the whole picture, to try to give it to them all at once, and then you are actually militating against the system of the textbook. I've learned that from bitter experience, too. It will be true that there'll be certain kids in that class who are sucking this up so fast they want more all at once. If you think you can work with some that way and not with the others, then have at it. But in my experience, I just say, wait, you'll find out. Do not neglect English to Latin translation. If there's one flaw the Oxford Latin course has, and I think Cambridge even more so, is they tend to neglect this. And Avery and I and Philip and this little cabal of classicists all think that there is something inordinately valuable about testing grasp of syntax in an active way. Can you put this English into Latin? So we don't neglect that, and we build that into the system. And my sort of tagline here is that what we try to do, and I think we've had some experience with it, is to make things rigorous, relevant, and fun. And I don't think those are mutually exclusive matters. Now, if you have too much fun, the rigor goes by the boards, and I can tell you one thing, with a lot of rigor, a lot of my kids would say, that's not fun. So you have to find a balance of some kind in these things. And a number of the slides we're going to show you now are ways that we're trying to achieve all of those things, the rigor, the relevance. Mostly the slides coming up are ways of getting at the relevance and the fun aspect. The rigor is there if you're teaching the language. If it doesn't deteriorate into a myth is fun class, which some programs do, the rigor will be there because this stuff is hard. I've been telling my seventh graders, no one told you that you're actually learning two languages, English and Latin, because most of them are learning English. Let's see, some elements contributing to success.
Okay, so we always try to spend a certain amount of time working with vocabulary enrichment, sometimes competitions, who can bring in the most bizarre word based on one of our vocabulary words, and someone just has come in with meso something dactylist is someone who hates playing the piano for practice. So that can be a lot of fun. And also very important for the English basis of improving their English via Latin. Oh yes, one of the things we also have is a classics club, which varies from time to time. Sometimes we have like 2 members, and sometimes we'll have 17 or 18. But every year, it's been a tradition in the work up to the PSAT. Our 10th graders and 11th graders all take the PSAT, one for practice, one for real. We offer a word a day in assembly. And in previous years, we've included things like funambulist and things like that. But this year, our kids said, well, let's do some roots, because the roots might actually show up on the PSAT. And though we can get yucks with these bizarre words, maybe if someone actually has heard about the root miso and know it means to hate, they might find a word on the SAT or the PSAT like misogynist and be able to figure out what it means. So we've done this every year, and it usually is very, very popular with the kids, and I think they learn something from it as well. We spend a lot of time talking about history and culture, and one of the reasons we actually like the Oxford over against the Cambridge is that it's all set in the first century BC, the lifetime of Horace, and it's such an amazingly important historical period. So we're talking about the assassination of Caesar, we're talking about the decline of the Senate. We work up to reading Cicero and some of those same authors from that period. So that's one of the most important things you're eight with the time that we have. Now, if you think about what Dr. Nordling does in 10 weeks, we do the same for Latin in the equivalent of about 3 years. So this is one of the reasons that the kids come out really solid and can keep it up and keep going through the rest of it. Right, the missing link. So we always have a few sections devoted to the gods and the heroes, and the kids are, I can't tell you how often they'll say, Dr. Springer, Dr. Springer, tell me a story. I'll say, okay, if we get through the exercise, then I'll tell you a story. And that is one way to vary the material and keep the kids interested and going with the material. Now, this is something we've had a wonderful time in our department, and this is partly because we've gotten a certain amount of financial assistance, both from our administration. Thank you, Dr. Springer, it's very important. We need steadfast, wise, and magnanimous donors. The school itself has a big program of earning money that then some of it is given out to the departments to use as they wish. So gathering things that you put in your department that are classical. So every time they look up from their book, they're seeing something that has to do with the material that we're looking at. So we'll show you a few of those. Now, media and technology, that's Jim's department. He put this whole thing together. I am a virtual Luddite. Every time I put together a nice show for Parents' Night or something, it doesn't work, and I'm left with blackboard chalk and voice. But there is a lot out there on the web, things you can do if you're clever with computers and so on. And the kids love it. Put a screen in front of them, and they're with you. This is really actually very important, and there is a feeling that, you know, the classicists, the kids who are doing Latin, are the Marines of the school, as someone said, the intensive Greek classes like the boot camp. And we intentionally will encourage them in the fact that they've made the right decision by trying deciding to take Latin, and that they become a kind of cadre within what is already a small school, but they have this sense of an esprit de corps. Right, and one of the other things that we've done, and it is something that actually they start in seventh grade and they're thinking about it for 3 or 4 years before they get to do it, we've been able to take students to Italy over our spring break for about a 10-day trip. And we divide it between Rome and the area around Pompeii, and that's a very esprit de corps building exercise, because we've got 10 or 11 days where we're doing nothing but classics. It's actually a very intensive course. Jim once overheard one kid saying to his parents, I didn't know it was going to be this academic. But we teach them a lot, and it creates a very kind of unified group. Yeah.
If you might well be thinking, well, that's great. You get to go to Italy. We can hardly cross the street. Well, I realize that. But think about wherever you live, I'll bet there's some building around you could look at and talk about the inspiration of classical architecture. So by all means, start on a modest scale, and maybe great things eventually will happen. But what we'd like to suggest are these are things that you can do whatever your resources, and they can be modest or they can be immodest. And we're lucky enough to have some wonderful resources. And this trip to Italy is an amazing builder of community within these students. I think I'm going to hand the mic back, but I've got a lot of pictures just to show you things that range from modest to not so.
So just about any time I see anything. Oh, yeah. Yeah, why don't you talk about that? Sorry.
We'll get to sort of in-house resources. This could go on and on and on, so I just pulled a few things out of my head, but there, a couple of these are really practical, particularly for a situation where you have maybe a single teacher who's feeling somewhat besieged and doesn't have a lot of support maybe within the immediate community. There's a lot of sort of virtual support there, and one of the best ones is the American Classical League. You can find all of these easily on the web if you type in these names and Google them. They all have web presences. Classical Association of Middle West and South has a standing committee, the Committee for the Promotion of Latin, and they are literally looking to give money away for projects. If you're interested in that and don't know anything about it, ask me later and I'll give you some information about that. And the American Philological Association is more and more interested in outreach and going in Latin instruction across levels, so there are resources there. I just picked three from the internet. It's frightening how much stuff there is out there. The Perseus Project is a place where you can find almost every classical text online, and you click on a word and it parses it for you. And I'm actually using that with my 11th graders now, which may shock some of you, but it's saving me a certain amount of time in the classroom so I can talk about other things besides what form is this. Art Store is a great database of images, but you have to have an institutional membership, so that's not something that an individual can get at, but if you have any access through university, it's amazing. And the last one seems relatively arbitrary, but you know, maps are a great thing to hook interest, and there are some wonderful free ones available online at the Ancient World Mapping Center. So back to you, Avery.
So this is a little tableau in my room. These are classical columns I found at, I think, like Garden Ridge or Michaels or something like that. Unfortunately, one young man decided to use the middle one as a footrest and left it in ruins, so I've maintained it in ruins, at one point having to pull it out of the trash bin due to my over-eager cleaning lady in the janitor in the place. But then, actually, one lady had put it in the trash, and the other lady took it out because she knew I liked it, so it stayed there permanently. And right above, this is a reproduction, this is not an original statue, that I think Philip found in Chicago somewhere. Again, it's sort of a garden store. So we have Augustus himself overlooking our central area around our classrooms. This is a chest. It's a little hard to see in this photograph, sorry about that. But it's a collection mostly of reproduction things that we've bought here, there, and everywhere. But Greek pots of different kinds, a piece of fake ancient glass. But then in the middle two shelves, we actually have a small coin collection. And this is something that we've been able to develop over the years with gifts from parents, buying mostly very inexpensive, relatively, I should say, inexpensive ancient coins to put on the shelf. And then we're very naughty because we see this as real realia, so we actually let our kids touch the coins. And they find it quite moving to hold in their hands something that may have been on the streets of Rome at the time of Julius Caesar. Please don't tell the museum curators because they would have a stroke. And this is a little hard to see. We try to get coins with different themes. This one is an architectural theme. So this is the Temple of Faustina on the coin, which now has been turned into, as those of you who've been to the forum may know, this church, which I can't think of what saint it's dedicated to, but the temple itself is there still off the back end of the church.
And the point of this is not to show off my primitive abilities with the slide program, but to emphasize again that what we're trying to do is make a connection between something that is old, that little coin, and something that they can see to this day when they go. And it just opens up many avenues for discussion and really for questions, and that surely is one of the things we want, is to stimulate questions among these young people so they get involved in this process. I think I've got a couple other coin ones. The coins are a great teaching resource, and you can find images of them online as well. So you can do what I'm doing without actually having the coins. This is one of my favorite things here. Here's obviously a very modern and a very not modern coin, and it's fun to talk about whom do we put on a coin anyway, and whom did the Romans put on a coin? And Pietas is a good conversation starter anyway, and under any circumstances, but the reverses of these two coins are particularly wonderful. Because it's great to show kids how some of this iconography just hasn't stopped over 2,000 years. And one of the things to be on the lookout for, if you can, when you're teaching kids, is overlap with other parts of their curriculum, particularly if they're in either an ancient history or in our school, it's called a world civilization. And when they're doing the units on the ancient world, try to plug into that and get a little homegrown interdisciplinarity going if you possibly can. And I think showing them coins like this is one way to do that. So another thing I've done is that on one of my trips, I got a pretty good picture of the forum. I took this from inside the Capitoline Museum where you get one of this little, just on this little verandas where we're overlooking the forum. And then it doesn't take a lot to be able to type in these little names like this. So in the Oxford Latin course, there are a couple of times when the story brings Quintus to the Roman Forum, and they mention some of these buildings, so it really helps the kids. And I think it builds and sustains interest to let them have sort of a visual aid, as it were, to what they're reading. If you're wondering what in the world this is periculum. And early on in teaching, I realized that there is place for this kind of fun and games. And it actually, I think you can do a pretty good job of reinforcing basic stuff. So it's hard to see the titles, but I've got one for conjugations and declensions, and I think it's Latin roots, and so forth and so on. So this is endlessly adaptable, and the kids, as you might guess, really have a good time. So with a younger audience, this is usually a hit. And you can think of all sorts of other game shows, I think, to have variations.
Then you can get downright silly. Colleagues of mine come up and say, what are you doing in this department? But a couple of years ago, Playmobil came out with a series on the Romans. So we have the Roman ship, which is in the front with a rather serious poster behind it. And then in the next slide, we have the Colosseum with as many gladiators as I could find. And the kids come in, and in a few minutes before class, they're firing the catapults and having the girls are always taking the lions and the tigers and putting them in the stand and making little signs saying, Jus Animalium, rights for animals. And so you get all sorts of silliness going on, but it's something that keeps the kids. They realize we have a sense of humor. Make them laugh is never a bad adjunct. Is this our last one?
Now, this last one is going to be probably very hard to see, but if you can see any of it, you're welcome to come look at it on the screen later, but it's just a final example of the ways you can waste or invest time in ways that will amuse the kids. So I'm going to try playing it. And make of it what you will.
Scintilla quintum rogat ut urnam impleat. Minotaurus quintum monet ne urnam rapiat, said Quintus Minotaurum winket.
And the special effects are astonishing. George Lucas has been in touch with me, but I haven't time for him. So you can make a little stop action film, and you might have guessed that was a lesson about indirect command. So there are lots of ways to do things that really get to them. Now, I have to
Truth in Advertising, full disclosure, when I do this kind of thing, years afterwards, the kids come up to me and all they remember is Ehu. So that's been my contribution to classical learning, it seems.
So at this point, we've probably talked your ears into deafness, but we're very happy to entertain any sort of question. I do have some of my cards somewhere here if you're interested in getting a hold of us at another date. Oh, yes, and then in the back table, if you want to look at the textbooks, some of which we talked about today, they're sitting out there. But if anybody has a question now that they'd like to answer, to ask us, or answer for us, yes.
No.
Yeah, we do orange, yellow, blue in 3 years. Our I'm not going to trouble you with what we call it, but our first actual real prose class is for the 10th graders, and then we use readings from the Oxford Reader, and then we also, the green one, and then we supplement that. My colleague is going to be reading the first Catilinarian, and I'm reading this from this little book called Murder at Larinum. Both more Cicero. Then in our junior year, the kids read Catullus and Horace. For those of you at a Lutheran school, Catullus might be off the menu, but Horace is pretty good, as we heard earlier. And then our senior year, we often can offer two sections, one of Virgil and one for those insane kids who want to do more Cicero. I don't understand them. But that's how our sequence works in the 6 years.
Just if you don't know, the Oxford Latin course comes in three parts, which are color-coded for our convenience. So that's congenial to doing one per year. And then there's a reader, which is actual texts. One thing I want to add, is that one advantage of the Oxford course is by the time you get to the third volume, so these are our ninth graders, they are actually exposed to unretouched Latin. They're reading, now it's heavily abridged, but they haven't messed with it. So they're reading, and it's not all the same old, so they actually get one of the epodes early on. It's really a cool thing to read.
And they read from the boar, and which we heard about earlier too. Yes?
The sentence analysis system in the Oxford Latin course is also a solid good. Ever since I taught from that system, I used it. I would also say for this audience that as regards the large gate in the
true. Take that, Winston Churchill. Any other questions?
I'll get to you, but Rob, what are you using now at the college level as an introductory text? Okay. Great. Okay.
And I would also mention that because of the two systems, that the new Latin for the new millennium is deliberately written as a middle ground, a middle road between the two approaches.
Okay.
And does very well that too.
Do you have a question back here? Yes.
I wondered if you ever had a Roman banquet.
Oh, actually, we do eat a lot. We. Oh, right. Yeah. I used to. I haven't done this recently, but I would do a roast leg of lamb. But then I discovered that many of the Midwestern kids don't eat lamb. So then I'd make chickens.
And one of the great resources associated with the American Classical League is the Junior Classical League, and there are all sorts of competitions. They support and sponsor. So that's another great way of getting your kids involved with other kids elsewhere. We haven't done a lot of that because our plates are full as it is, but many schools do that.
Any other questions? Yes.
I'm wondering about the transition into college and kind of the longer term. How many of your students are
sitting in? That's a sore point. And actually, it's one of the things that we thought a lot about in terms of our curriculum, because for many of our students, this is as much Latin as they ever get. But you never know. I can't tell you how many times some kid that we virtually had given up with will show up at our door and say, Dr. Springer, you'll never guess, I'm a classics major. And, you know, we're sort of, oh, really? No, but I mean, so we've had a lot of, in fact, right now, a student, very gratifying student who went off and did economics and classics, was an investment banker for a couple of years, saw the light, and is now working toward a PhD in classics. So it's, there's a little trickle, but most of these kids are pretty career-oriented. Lots of them are thinking law, which feeds into our Latin, medicine also, but then business and things like that as well. So there's only a little trickle that tend to go on. Any other questions? Yes. There are also a number of state classical associations. So in Illinois, for example, the Illinois Classical Conference is really mostly high school teachers. There are college professors who get involved in it too, but and I don't know. I imagine there's one in Indiana and elsewhere in the Midwest, but you're absolutely right, John. They can be really helpful. We're very lucky because we have 3, 4, or 5 of us working, but that's not always the case.
And one of the things I didn't do, but I talked not at all about the Cambridge Latin course, but one of its virtues is there's an immense amount of ancillary material with it. If you go to the website, I think there's a website devoted to it. So there's a lot of support available for that one. Oxford, not so much that I've been able to find. I don't quite know why, but... So if you're looking for something in that style where there, you know, there's going to be a lot of support, Cambridge has got a lot. I'm not sure about the one called Ecce Romani, but I suspect it's got quite a lot too.
Yes?
My son's going to be 2 years old in December, and my wife and I are starting to think about maybe we'll go the homeschooling route. She and I both have some Greek and Hebrew, but we don't have any Latin background between the two of us. Should my wife and I go to...
Start now. Well, one thing I kind of like about the Oxford, I think you could actually teach yourself as you teach your child. Or, you know, start now, spend 3 years working through Oxford, and then when you think he's ready or she to start, then you've got some background. But otherwise, I always recommend going and taking Latin. It's never too late.